switch gears and turn it over to your official session moderator, Jeff Brewer, who's going to be joining us from USACE. And so, Jeff, I'm going to move the view over to you, and I will let you get things started as I call up the agenda for our session today.
All right. Thanks, Jean. Hey, this is the second of our M2S2 webinars series for this fiscal year of 22, I believe we're in. And we're going to do another three sessions next year in FY23. And we'll come out with the agenda for those. But if you'll see the agenda up on the screen, we are going to start each session precisely on time. And these are Eastern Standard Times. So at 1:10, we will start the first session. And then at 1:40, the second, and at 2:20. That way, if there's people that would just like to sit in on one particular session, then they know exactly what time to start. Again, Gene, sorry to talk to you about the Q&A box. So I've got about 5 minutes here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and introduce the instructors one by one. They're going to give you just a little bit of a little rundown on who they are. And then at precisely at 1:10, then we'll start the first session. So I'd like to introduce Mr. Richard Perry. If you could go ahead and just chime in and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Richard Perry. I'm a geophysicist with the Army Corps Engineering Support Center in Huntsville. I've been with the Corps for about 5 years now. Previous to coming to the Corps, I was a contractor supporting the MMRP program for about 14 years. Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Perry. Second presenter we'll have is Dr. Heather McDonald.
Hello, everyone. My name is Heather McDonald, and I'm a technical manager at Huntsville Center. I worked for the Corps for about 4 years, and my background is I have an undergraduate degree in chemical engineering and graduate degrees in environmental engineering. And my research was completely different than what I work on now, but that's all right because I really like what I do. So,
thanks, Dr. McDonald. And the last one we have is Julie Ainge.
Hi, everybody. I'm Julie Ainge. I am the chief of the Environmental Protection and Utilities Branch at Huntsville Center with the Corps. I've had that role since about the beginning of this year. Prior to that, I was a technical manager within the branch for about 5 years. And I started my career with about 10 years doing primarily munitions response work with the Alabama Department of Environmental Management as an environmental regulator.
Thanks, Julie. All right, those will be our instructors today. At the end of the presentation, we got a couple slides talking about the next slide. In fact, could you bring up the next slide there for me? Thank you. There we go. This will be the next webinar we have. It'll be on July 20th, Risk Assessment in the REOs for Munitions Response. Again, go to Clue In just like you did for this one to register. And Gene then will make sure everybody gets the information on how to chime in on the presentations. So that slide will come up again later on today, and I've already sent out a lot of emails to different services, branches, and offices that should be forwarding that out to everybody. But keep that on your calendar. Again, we'll put that slide up again at the end of the our presentations today. And with that, I think that's all we've got. I've got just like a couple minutes, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. So again, I'd like to introduce Mr. Richard Perry. If you want to go ahead and share your screen and bring up a presentation.
Is it coming through okay?
It's coming through perfectly. Go right ahead.
Okay. So again, my name is Richard Perry. I'm with geophysicists with the Engineering Support Center in Huntsville, Alabama. I was going to talk to you all today about evolution of the conceptual site model for Bostock bomb target. And I've tried to insert pictures to just give you an idea of some of the work that was conducted and what the field teams dealt with. This first picture we have is from our 2019 field season. We were doing data collection along the transect. So what you would expect for a site like this, we'll get into it, but quite a bit of vegetation and elements that the teams are dealing with. Okay, so just wanted to acknowledge that the figures and content of this presentation, they are sourced from our draft final RFIS report. This report is still in development and it's not quite finalized yet. And then another picture here, also from our 2019 field season. This is some dynamic data collection with our EM61 in one of our grids. And you can see the gentleman there collecting, and then they have their R10 GPS. In fact, let me switch over, maybe point it out better. We got our GPS here, our data logger here, and they are surveying the grid. Before we get into it, did want to go over some acronyms that you'll see in this presentation. I think a lot of us are familiar with them, but for those that are not, advanced geophysical classification was one component that we did during the field work for this site. You'll see that is abbreviated AGC, anomalies per acre, which we'll get into that. Just skipping down, conceptual site models, a CSM. Digital geophysical mapping will be DGM, and then one of our stakeholders, Florida Department of Environmental Protection. Skipping down, let you look over a little bit, but we will talk about some munitions and explosive of concern, some MEC, some munitions debris. Another one of our stakeholders, which would be the St. Louis District, MVS. And then skipping down to the bottom, we'll talk about, we'll have a figure later on from visual sampling plan that we'll talk about, and that's abbreviated VSP. Okay, so to go into our stakeholders, they included the Army Corps of Engineers Jacksonville District, the Engineering Support Center in Huntsville, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, and of course the property owners who actually own the property that we did the project on. And wanted to point out that all of these stakeholders, they were all participate in development of the project approach, our technical approach and sampling that we did on the site. Our picture over to the right is from our 2019 field season. The two personnel there are queuing targets with the TIMTADS, which is an AGC Advanced Geophysical Classification Instrument. This particular work is done following the dynamic survey where we actually identified targets of interest. And these folks are going and actually doing a queued survey, a static survey over each one of those targets of interest. This is done prior to the intrusive investigation. Okay, so we'll jump into site history. So in 1940, the Navy acquired 640 acres about 3 miles northwest of Bostwick in Putnam County, Florida. And the target became known as both the Bostwick bomb target and the Putnam bombing range. I believe for this presentation, I mainly refer to it as the Bostwick bomb target, but you can see in the map there, it's about an hour or so, hour and a half south of Jacksonville, Florida. Okay, so continuing on our site history. So the inventory project report, it confirmed the location and historical use of this site. The bomb target, which is right here in the central portion of the MRS, the bomb target was calculated to extend beyond the target center by about 3,000 feet for a total of 649 acres. And originally it was the 640 acre red box here. It included safety buffers for uncertainties in altitude and flight speed of the training aircraft, which will become important later as we discuss the evolution of the CSM. I did want to point out there's no historical evidence of bombing activities outside of this 640-acre FUDS property. And you're probably asking yourself where we have this large range fan, the yellow fan. And this is from the 2004 archive search report and established the fan about just over 3,100 acres. And this was based on how far an aircraft rocket could travel after it was fired. The point being, when they went to hit the bomb target, they were flying training aircraft and dropping the munitions on the target. So one more slide, I believe, about site history. Some important things to note. Here is the 640-acre bomb target that we talked about. This is the actual, if you can look, looking at the historical photograph, there is an approach vector that the training aircraft came from the north heading to the south to hit the target, and then also coming from the south heading to the north to hit the target. So, and that's going to come in to great importance later as we get into this presentation. A couple things to point out. There was some MEG that was found during the 2010 SI down in this location here, as well as some munitions debris. Okay, so let's talk about the current use and receptors. So the MRS is primarily used for pine tree harvesting. The preliminary conceptual site model for the MRS indicated potentially complete pathways for MEC and MC and exposure to human receptors at the MRS. And that's talks about the on-site workers, the timber harvesting, the wetland surveyors, and of course, any recreational users. And I wanted to include this picture over to the right. This is from the 2020 field season. This is a transect prior to brush cutting, but it's what you expect in that part of Florida. Very thick, very challenging to deal with. Okay, moving along to the data quality objective. So the project DQOs were to obtain data to characterize the nature and extent of any MEC or MC contamination present at the MRS. This picture below is from the 2020 field season. All these items were all munitions debris. You're looking at a Mark I 275-inch rocket warheads, some BDU-33 practice bombs, and a Mark 89 practice bomb. But all of these were munitions debris. There was no MEC found there. So let's talk about the field work that was done. I've kind of alluded to it. There were two field seasons, both in 2019 and 2020. So the initial RI characterization effort, again, it's centered around the 640-acre target. And that was for both the 2019 and 2020 field season. So we collected dynamic DGM primarily along these transects that you see. The purple transects are from the 2019 field season, and they were based on, they were spaced 547 feet apart, and they were based on detecting a 275-inch rocket target area. Now, during the 2019 field season, we did find some 20-millimeter projectile munitions debris. Those were not anticipated, not part of the initial conceptual site model. So this led to a data gap, and so it warranted an additional investigation during the 2020 field season. And then we move into the 2020 field season, and you can see that the orange transects, they're 275 feet apart. And during the field season, because the 20 is a lot harder to detect, we actually lowered the height. The standard height of 61 is 42 centimeters. We lowered that down to 20 centimeters. And we did that to aid in the detection of the 20-millimeter projectile. And just looking at the figure over on the right, you can see, again, the purple transects from the 2019 field season, the yellow transects from, I'm sorry, the orange transects from the 2020 field season, and then the smaller polygons and symbology you see, those are the various grids that we collected in each field season. The yellow grids were from 2019, and the green grids were collected in 2020. So we talked about VSP back in the acronym list, but following the dynamic survey, we did get an anomaly density map that was generated in VSP. Now, we had two different coal heights in 2019 versus 2020 survey data. So for 2019, we did an analysis in VSP, and for 2020, we did a separate independent analysis. So the critical density, and if I could discuss, the critical density is basically the boundary where we go from a high density area, kind of in this large red bullseye here, to a lower density. So that's what that critical density is. And that line for the 2019 data was 350 anomalies per acre. And that was based on our dynamic transect survey.
Richard, I'm so sorry. Before you go any further, You see at the very bottom of your screen how it says the US Zoom is sharing your screen. Just to the right, there's a little hide link. If you click that,
gotcha.
Thank you so much.
Sorry about that. Thank you. To go back, so during the 2020 field season, we collected additional data beyond that 640-acre target area. And we ended up coming up with a critical density of 80 anomalies per acre. And you can see some of that down in this area, for example. And then the other thing I wanted to point out goes back to receptors. If you see this hatched area that's common throughout the MRS, that is the area where timber harvesting is conducted. So just let you know how extensive that is across the site. So following where we had the anomaly density and we had those boundaries, the PDT was presented proposed grid locations. These grid locations were placed in the higher density area where some of the grids to try and confirm what the nature of some of that high density amount of targets that we saw. And then we also had grids that were placed in the low density outside of that. And we had variable dimensions that were used anywhere from 50 by 50 to 33 by over 1,000. And the reason that that long rectangular grid is because given that it was timber harvesting, they do plant in rows on the site. And so that led to those long rectangular grids where we collect in between the tree rows. So the grids collected during the 2019 season were collected at the standard coil height of 42 centimeters. And we used 5 millivolts on channel 2 with the EM61 to detect that TOI. And then the grids collected during the 2020 field season, again, we used a lower coil height of 20 centimeters, but we did have a threshold of 9.6 because when you lower the coil to the ground, you do end up with a higher signal to noise ratio. So that is part of the reason why we added that. So following that dynamic survey in the high density grids, we did a queued survey of the targets of interest. In the 2019 field season, we used the TIMTADS 2x2 to do a queued AGC survey. And then in the 2020 field season, we used the Metal Mapper 2x2. And this particular picture is from the 2020 field season and collected in one of our high density grids. So after we completed our queued survey, we dug all of our targets of interest. And as part of that, we ended up with a total of just over 1,700 investigations. And we did dig along both transects and in grids. So following that intrusive investigation, we ended up with about 1,300 pounds of munitions debris, some small arms, and about 185 pounds of non-munitions related debris. I wanted to reiterate that during the RI, we found no mech items during that investigation. And talking about the pictures here, you can see one personnel is doing some manual excavation of a TOI. And that's for some of the shallower ones. You can see the GPS in the background there that they were using. And then additionally in the upper right, you can see also during the 2019 field season for some of the deeper targets of interest, they used a mechanical excavator to aid in that intrusive investigation. So let's talk about some intrusive results. Here we're looking at the high use areas. We had quite a bit that was used. The 225 inch practice rocket, the 275 inch practice rocket, again, the 20 millimeter training practice projectile, the 3 pound practice bomb. And I did want to point out on this that we had that even though we did find the practice bombs down to 40 inches, the model depth of detection that we had for the Metal Mapper was only down to 21.7 inches. This basically means that we were not able to get some of the deeper, we were not able to select some of the deeper 3 pound practice bombs as TOI at this site. That limitation of that data was noted in the data usability assessment that was, that's part of the report for this site. To go down and talk some more, again, the hot 5-inch Havar practice rockets and 250-pound practice bombs and 56-pound practice bombs. And we found a total of 549. And again, these were all munitions debris. everything that was found. So then we also did digging outside of the high use areas and the low use areas and some grids. Pretty similar to what we saw in the high use area. Again, the 225 practice rocket, the 20 millimeter, the 3-pound practice bombs, the BDU-33, and things like the Mark 89 56-pound practice bomb. And we found a total of 66 of these outside of the high use area. And then this, we have those results plotted on our map. Again, this is the 649 acre target area. And then we have the symbology of where the various munitions items were located. So after we got done doing the field work, we noticed a couple things that didn't quite seem to line up. So we went back and we talked to St. Louis District, and we wanted to reassess that 3,100 acre range fan that was generated from the 2004 archive search report. Now, that range fan at the time when the ASR was done was a standard air-to-ground rocket range that was developed by St. Louis in the early 2000s based on historical range regulations that they had available at that time. Now, the findings from the RI, they did not match up to that 3,100 acre range fan, and it was not reflective of the training that had been conducted at the site. So based on these findings and follow-up PDT meetings with St. Louis, St. Louis noted that additional historical range regulations had been used since the early 2000s. So from the additional regulations, the figure to the right is a rocket range fan drawn from 1947. This was incorporated into the conceptual site model versus the 3,100 acre range fan from the 2004 ASR. And this was done and it more accurately reflected the on-site training that was conducted, and it lined up with the findings that we had from the remedial investigation. And if you look, I know it's hard to read, but it's basically the smaller range fan. It comes up, it's about 6,500 feet by about 4,000 feet. It's significantly smaller than that 3,100 acre range fan that we started with. So based on that, we did revise the high use area, our low use area, and our no evidence of use boundaries. Looking at the figure, looking at the RI results, and remembering that we looking at all the historical records, looking at the findings from the RI, the findings seem to indicate that we had the training aircraft that started from the north and headed south, and then also their other approach vectors starting from the south and headed north. So this ends up giving us this little bit of a lopsided kind of an hourglass shape, where we came up with the two overlapping range fans. And again, this is based on the updated regulations that St. Louis was able to provide to us, and it matched much better to what we had found from the RI. So per the final, the acreage for the high use area, it was revised to 189 acres, the low use area to just over 1,000 acres. And then the no evidence of use area, which is from the legacy range fan, ends up being 1,800. We'll get into that later on why that's important as well. So some lessons learned. Throughout the RI phase, it's important for the PDTs to confirm the MRS boundaries in line with the historical data, training records, historical photographs, interviews, findings from previous investigations. That all needs to be incorporated, and the PDT needs to be thinking about that. So if the shape of the MRS boundary is not indicative of the historical training and RI results, that should be a red flag, and the PDT should follow up with St. Louis. We need to make sure that we understand the origin of our MRS boundary and how it was applied. This point is particularly important for the older ASRs. For example, ours was from 2004. Where more historical regulations are now available and used to ensure the MRS boundary is still applicable. So we talked, I mentioned on the last slide about how we need to still account for that original FUDS acreage, must still be accounted for if there's an MRS boundary reduction. We can't just throw it out. That still has to be tracked. And then this comes to the end of my presentation, and this particular one picture is from a transect from the 2020 field season that the crews had to deal with. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Perry. We've got about 9 questions in the queue, so I'm going to kind of run through them and just answer them as best you can. All right. So first question is, where can we find the final report when it is finalized?
So it'll be part of the public record. USACE will have a copy of it, and then there also will be a copy that should be sourced locally as well, part of the administrative record. So those will be various places that that we will have that document.
All right. And next question is, how many targets of interest were there?
So the targets of interest, don't have that off the top of my head, but important thing to note is we did only do a AGC survey in the high density area, but we did dig all of those targets. So I don't have the TOI off the top of my head, but again, we did have over 1,700 intrusive investigations, so it was a smaller population than that.
All right, some of the questions keep jumping up and disappearing here. Is there an acronym list for M2S2?
I'm sure there is. I tried to include all the acronyms that I had, but that slide was getting very busy.
All right. Did the RI work? Question here keeps shifting around here. Okay, here we go. Did the RI work shift or improve your initial conceptual site model? And that's the question. And it says, I'm curious about any refinement that you may have made to the CSM.
Absolutely. The RI sampling, as I noted, it identified a piece of munitions that we did not have as part of CSM. It showed that we did need to expand outside of that 640-acre target area in various places. So it absolutely, and then it was fundamental in realizing that the range fan that we have was not indicative of the training that was conducted. So it was very important.
All right, next one says, great presentation so far. How did you decide on the quality, or I'm sorry, the quantity of grids to be placed within high density areas?
We tried to look at, back on the anomaly density figure, we did try to, inside of that, there were various hotter areas and cooler areas, even inside of the high use area. We tried to place those both geospatially across that area, as well as trying to sample the various anomaly densities. So we had a good sampling across the whole HUA. And then also in the low use area, we had various features on the site that could have been things like impact craters and whatnot that we wanted to put some grids there to take a look and see what was there.
Okay. Next question is, you mentioned VSP. What is that?
VSP is a visual sampling plan. We use it to help decide how we're going to sample these munitions response sites. So for our site in particular, if you go into VSP, you input, for example, your MRS boundary, and then you look for, you look at your conceptual site model and you figure out a target area that you're looking for. So for 2019, we were looking for the 275 inch rocket. So our initial sampling was based on transects to both traverse and detect that target. We realized from that 2019 field work that that wasn't quite going to do it because we had a smaller target area via the 20 mils that could potentially be out there. So we had tighter spacing, I believe it's 275 feet apart, to look for that 20 millimeter. And so we did additional transects that were tighter spaced to look for that smaller target area. And so that's what VSP basically is. It helps you design that sampling approach. And then once you conduct that sampling approach, in our case, we did the dynamic transects using the M61, you can generate a heat map, an anomalies per acre map. And that showed the kriging that we saw previously. And from that, you get an idea of where your high use area boundary is, where your low use area boundary is, and then you go and place grids in those and actually do some intrusive sampling to figure out what the nature of those hotspots are. And it's free software, publicly available.
All right. Next question is, are you using any visual software for managing your site data for the conceptual site model, like, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, EQUIS, E-Q-U-I-S?
I apologize. I'm not familiar with that. We do have all of our data. It is all geospatially in a GIS platform, Esri ArcMap. We have it in that location. We have all of the geophysical data that was collected both with GPS and the AGC data that was also collected with GPS. We have all of that geospatially recorded, and that is part of the project record. And the maps that I showed you are actually, that all comes from ArcMap, where that information is stored.
Okay. Next question. Your conceptual site model looks very 2D. Was there any analysis in 3D?
There was. I had some tables showing the vertical distribution of some of the MD that was found, and there were some additional figures that I could have pulled as well from the report that shows the three dimension. But yes, versus the horizontal, it's also very important to get an idea of the vertical distribution of any munitions debris on the site.
All right. Questions keep rolling in, by the way. So we've got about 4 minutes left here. Next question. Sorry if I missed it. Was the 2019 reinterpreted for shallow 20 millimeter projectiles, even if that data couldn't detect deeper ones after the COA was lowered for the 2020 field session?
So no, because it'd be like a little bit like mixing apples and oranges. The 2020 field season, in addition to covering the transects from the 2019 field season, it had transects that were spaced roughly halfway in between. And so even though we didn't re-examine the 2019 data, we did cover that data with transects with the 2020 field season at the shorter coil height of 20 centimeters.
Okay. Any info on the MC aspects of the conceptual site model?
I did not include that as part of the presentation. If I'm understanding right, from an MC perspective, maybe I'm not understanding it right. Well, we did not find anything.
Okay. Would the discovery of MEC change the approach, especially if MEC was discovered outside the high use area?
Absolutely. And I did want to point out that there was MEC found during the SI that was done prior to the remedial investigation. And so we're not walking away from this area. There is going to be further remediation that will be necessary, but absolutely.
All right. Got just a couple minutes here. Got two more questions. Can you explain how the target threshold was chosen after lowering the height of the EM61?
Yeah, we did a depth response curve, and that was using the, we have a depth response curve, which can be used that you plug in your munition and your offset of the coil, and that can be modeled in various softwares. And then you can input the site noise that, for example, from the geology on the site or whatnot. And as long as it's above that site noise and it's wherever that curve is above the site noise, that gave us an idea of where we would be able to detect the various items of interest.
All right, last question. What PPE and other precautions were used while in the field?
I believe, and it was just your standard. If the teams were out there, they had your safety boots, they had their high vis, they had, if they were around any sort of machinery, you know, they would have used hard hats and whatnot. So it was basically for the folks who were collecting the geophysical data, not much more than some safety glasses, some vest, and some boots, I believe level D. But for folks who are actually digging or working on an excavator, they obviously had a higher level of PPE that was necessary.
Okay, perfect. That's actually all the questions we got, and we're finishing up right on time. Very good. Appreciate it, Mr. Perry. So with that, we're going to go ahead and roll into the next presentation. And that'll be Dr. Heather McDonald, when you are ready to share your screen.
Okay.
You may begin.
Okay, is that coming up?
I'm still seeing a black screen at the moment. It may be just taking a second.
Okay.
Yeah, and while you're waiting, if you'd like to enable your camera as well, we can confirm that that will be
okay. I'm going to do that too. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, your slides are up okay. And your video's up.
Okay, great. All right, hello everyone. Today I'm going to talk about a case study for a site at Redstone Arsenal. We called it Marshall 3. And it's the development of the CSM and how we're going to refine it. Okay, so the agenda will first give some information about the site location, the background of the site, and how it ties into Redstone Arsenal and Marshall Space Flight Center. And then our initial site characterization activities for the site, and that's kind of the geophysical data and was collected, as well as the intrusive investigation results and sampling. And then our selected interim measures alternative that came out as a result of those investigations. And then now the interim measures implementation that we are currently carrying out. So Marshall 3 is located in the central part of Redstone Arsenal. Redstone Arsenal is this black and white dashed area here. It is located west of Huntsville and south of Huntsville. And Marshall 3 is the red dot here and within that. And it's a very busy part of Redstone Arsenal. It's within Marshall Space Flight Center, which is has a lease from the Army for that area. We have Blue Origin is leasing space from NASA for a test stand that's west of our site. We also have the historical place the historic Redstone test stand just north of our site. And we have a little bit further northeast is we have an FBI facility. So it's a very busy part of the arsenal. So some background into Redstone Arsenal in general. So we, as I've mentioned before, it's next to Huntsville, Alabama within Madison County. And it was formerly comprised of three separate areas. We have the Redstone Ordnance Plant, Huntsville Arsenal, and the Gulf Chemical Warfare Depot. And all of these facilities were used in the 40s to produce conventional and chemical munitions for use in World War II. Munitions casings were filled at Hart's Huntsville Arsenal, and that was had three production plants, which produced several types of chemical warfare material munitions. And once they were filled at Huntsville Arsenal, then they were transported to Redstone Ordnance Plant for final assembly. After World War II, Redstone Arsenal's mission changed into research and development of rocketry and guided missile systems. And then the three facilities were combined into one facility under the name Redstone Arsenal. And Redstone Arsenal, regulatory-wise, it's currently under a RCRA Subpart X permit. So, and that permit is administered by the state of Alabama. And so that dictates a lot of the way we do things as far as our investigations and our cleanup strategies. So continuing on with the background, in 1960, Marshall Space Flight Center was established and within the Huntsville Arsenal plants area. And so NASA has a 100-year lease with the Army for this property for Marshall Space Flight Center. And Marshall Space Flight Center, Marshall 3 lies within that property. And it encompasses about 50 acres. And historically speaking, it was a waste disposal area within Huntsville Arsenal. And so because it's on NASA property, there's a lot of activities at the site. They include office support, test stand operation, pump house support to the test stands, and I'll kind of point some of these areas out as we see some figures later. So specific to Marshall 3, we have that the site boundary was established by the Army in 2007, and it includes four historical waste disposal areas. We have Marshall 3, which is the what we call the boneyard, and this was used based on historical information by various laboratories and construction contractors to dispose of scrap material and waste. And then we have Marshall 3E, which is east of Marshall 3, and I'll give, you'll see this on a figure in a moment. And so when the historic test stand that I mentioned was established, they had to excavate some soil to install water reservoirs for cooling water for the test stand. And so that excavated soil is what is known as Marshall 3E, where that soil was relocated to. And then we have the final two areas are Marshall 82 and 82 South. And this is the southern two-thirds of the area of Marshall 3. And they're within a boundary of what we call Historical Area 11. And these had a slightly different site use. And they were documented as having accepted reject chemical munitions from the deactivation of Huntsville Arsenal. And they were noted as having burning and destruction grounds for different types of chemical agent and also white phosphorus. So here's a figure showing those four areas. So we've got the main area, which was our boneyard, the blue area, which is three. Then 3E is across this Dodd Road here that runs north-south, where our the soil that was excavated for the tanks was disposed of. And then we have 82 and 82 South, which were our disposal and destruction areas. So because of the varied site history with these portions of the site, it was split up into three MRSs, munitions response sites. So MRS 1, which is the eastern portion of the site, that includes the historical waste disposal landfills located that were referred to as Marshall 3E. And field work, which I'll discuss more in depth, determined that there were munitions and explosives of concern present in these disposal areas. However, no CWM, chemical warfare material, was identified in that area. And then MRS-2 is our central area where that was what we refer to as the boneyard. And that was field work that I'll describe confirmed we have numerous individual single point anomalies that contain MET, and also some other kind of debris associated with disposal of munitions. And then we have the third MRS, which is associated with the Marshall 82 and 82 South areas. And those had the more of a destruction operation. So I've mentioned that Redstone has a RCRA permit, and the permit lists all of this solid waste management units within Redstone Arsenal, of which Marshall 3 is one. And it specifically is listed as a SMU that requires an interim measures and or source removal. And it also requires a RCRA facility investigation. And the permit language specifically requires for this site that that we need to have an interim measures work plan to include removal of disposed chemical munitions, toxic materials, chemical waste, and burn pits. And so this is a pretty big site. It's a pretty big job. So what we did to facilitate that interim measures work plan is we split the interim measures phase into two parts. First, was phase one, where we characterize the site and we find out what is there and where is it. And then phase two would be where we implement the interim measure. And at phase two is where we produce that interim measures work plan. So phase one investigation of MRS 1 and 2 was completed in 2016. And MRS 3, we're anticipating to award phase one investigation for that work and this fiscal year. And we separated those because MRS 3 is historically associated with other operations. And so we're going to save that for a later time. So in order to characterize our MRS 1 and 2 during the phase one activities, we did a few things. We performed geophysics using an EM61 as well as an EM31. And also we did some TEMTEV surveys on a few grids within the site. As a result of the geophysics, we identified nearly 12,000 single point anomalies within, and all of those single point anomalies were within MRS2, the boneyard, the central area. And then we also identified 27 area targets. And area targets are where our geophysical data, response data shows just so many anomalies in one particular area that they can't be, you can't separate them individually. So we just say that it's a saturated response area, one large area. So after the geophysics, so we had an idea of where we wanted to investigate to see what was there based on the geophysical data. So we used that, some of that advanced classification from the TEMTAS, and all of that was used to determine 310 single point anomaly locations that were intrusively investigated. And then in order to characterize the area targets, we excavated 36 test pits located within those area targets. We also performed some environmental sampling. So we did some groundwater and soil sampling. Then if a single point anomaly was the location of a MEC item, then soil samples were collected below that location. And then if we saw evidence of burning operations, like discolored soil or disposal pits, things like that, soil samples were taken in those areas as well. And then for area targets, So we installed 8 soil borings, and so then collected different quantities of soil at different levels. And we also collected 11 groundwater samples. And all of those samples were analyzed. So because we have, this site has an elevated chemical CWM probability, they first require a head spacing for chemical agents on site, which in this case, they were head spaced for mustard and lewisite. And then once those are clear, those get the soil samples were collected in triplicate. And so they'll go back, and once those are clear on site, they get sent to off-site lab for further screening for chemical agent. And if those samples come up as clear for a chemical agent, then they're sent into our analytical lab for other analytes, such as our standard package, which would be VOCs, SVOCs, metals, explosives, and so on. So as far as the area targets, so I mentioned we had a number of area targets, and here are where they're at. We have our MRS1, which are the area targets. Those are in yellow, and there were no single point anomalies identified in that MRS. And then MRS2, which is our middle MRS, and you can see the location of those area targets. We like to refer to this large one as home plate. So it's a very big saturated response area, as you can see. And then we have, so MRS2, we have our single point anomalies. And as I mentioned, we have over 10,000 single point anomalies. So that's quite a lot of anomalies to dig. So just keep that in mind going forward. So as far as once we did our intrusive investigation, these are our results that we have found regarding munitions and explosives of concern. There were a couple of potential CWM items found at the site, but they were later determined to be munitions debris. And then we have a number of munitions and explosives of concern. And then finally, we have a number of MD items that were found. And then we did see evidence of burn pits and chemical drum debris. And these are what we call our permit specified features. And those were evidenced in several locations. And here is a figure of our MEC intrusive results. So we have, this is our home plate up here. We did the yellow triangles, our test pit locations. And so, you can see some results. Say, for example, this test pit produced some 4.2-inch mortars. And then we have test pits over in different parts, you know, within each of our saturated response areas. And the permit specified features, we found evidence of in several locations, and those include burn pits, containers such as drums, and things like that. So our intrusive investigation is definitely showing evidence of what we've based on the historical background, what we might expect to see at the site. So in summary of the phase one characterization, so based on the results, we can establish that we need to perform some kind of interim measure at the site in order to address the unacceptable near-term hazard and risk to human health in the environment posed by munitions and explosives of concern and potential CWM. So our objectives of for the IM were to minimize direct and current and future direct exposure to MEC, and to minimize current and future direct or indirect exposure to chemical agent or chemical agent containing material. So the IM process is very similar to going through at like a RIFS and then producing a decision document. And so we look at alternatives and screen them for which interim measures alternative we want to select. And the selected alternative from that process was to remove our MEC and permit specified disposal features using AGC. And so we want to go and remove all of the MEC and permit specified features in MRS 1 and 2. Remember that MRS 3 isn't included in this part of the investigation and interim measure. And in order to apply our AGC, we're going to perform full coverage AGC in our central MRS, MRS2, where we had all those single point anomalies. And what our goal here for the AGC is to determine to find our targets of interest. And our targets of interest for that site, based on the historical background, is the 4.2-inch mortar, and this is the only munition likely to be chemically configured at this site. And this is an example here of a 4.2-inch mortar that we used during our QA seeding process. And so then the AGC data collected will be used to classify all anomalies as either targets of interest or non-targets of interest. And hopefully then the anomalies that we'll have to dig we think are potentially CWM aren't 12,000 anomalies. It would be a lot less than that number. And therefore, we'll only be investigating those targets of interest and our area targets under full CWM protocol. And this approach will result hopefully in excavating fewer anomalies. And the reason this is so important is because when we investigate under CWM protocols, it requires a lot more personnel and things like we have to have real-time air monitoring. We have to have a personal decontamination station. We have to have emergency personnel on site at all times. And this is all required by regulations for CWM sites. So if we don't have to have all of that level of effort for the field work, that would really reduce what the time and money that it would cost to do the interim measure for the site. So here's just a slide showing our selected interim measure, which I mentioned. So MRS1, we're going to excavate all of these area targets. MRS2, we're going to excavate the area targets, but also perform full coverage AGC within that entire MRS. And so that brings us to late last year, where we did our AGC collection using two methods. Most of the site, we were able to do perform full coverage using our Ultra-10 classifier, which is shown here on the right. And then a small portion of the site was covered using the screener, and this is a person portable litter. And it's used, for example, in areas like in the picture where you see a slope or maybe areas that are very close to buildings where our classifier cannot reach. And then the rest of the site was either comprised of a building or a tank or a portion that we could not collect data. Here are the results from our AGC collection. So what happened here is we have a reduction, we're able to see a reduction in the size of the footprint for our area target. If you remember, this was our home plate, and we were able to shrink it somewhat here as far as having a saturated response area. So the table here at the right shows our acreage before AGC and after AGC. And you can see we have a nearly 20% reduction in our saturated response area. So that's potentially a savings of a lot of time and effort to that we don't have to go in here and excavate all of those, that much less acreage. So we are currently underway with field work for these area targets. And so we have several area targets that have been completed, several that are being excavated right now. This large one here, MRS 102, is currently being excavated. We have a couple other small ones, and it's, this is a multi-year field effort. And another thing that's interesting about this site, because as I mentioned, we have a lot of nearby site tenants, people working, office buildings, test stands. All of our field work takes place for our intrusive operations at night. So that makes it also a lot more challenging. And this is an example of an area target excavation, that MRS1-02. And you can start to see here on the edges, we have some evidence of our ash and such, but we have to have light towers, and all of this work has to be taking place after hours for when most people are working. Okay, so that was the area target. So we were also able to refine the CSM with AGC for the single point anomaly. So as I mentioned, we had almost 12,000 single point anomalies using our EM61 data. And then from our AGC data, we have 17,000 anomalies. Now that seems like, wow, we just got more anomalies. And while that's true, and it's because our AGC sensor coils can have a higher resolution than the EM61. So where some of these 12,000 anomalies might be, one anomaly of the EM61, the resolution could, for AGC, that might end up being two anomalies in that data. But the really great thing we can do with this data set is to look at our targets of interest. So based on the AGC data, we determined that there were a total of 672 targets of interest. And so that means they're very likely to be a 4.2-inch mortar. And that's the one that we're looking for, that the only munition that we expect to have a CWM fill that we would require to be excavated under CWM protocols. So we investigated those under CWM protocols, and then the remaining 17,000 anomalies that are left out of that six after those six were excavated, we are planning to investigate under CWM contingency protocols. So that those are not requiring real-time air monitoring and all the emergency personnel to be present on site when those happen. So because of that, so that's a 96% reduction in the number of anomalies that we have to investigate under CWM protocols. So that represents a huge cost savings to us. And here's a visual representation of what we went from. So that we had our before AGC here on the right, where we had many single point anomalies to excavate under CWM. And then now we can excavate only a very small subset of those anomalies. And I don't think I mentioned on this slide, but we are going to excavate all of our anomalies, but we just aren't doing them all under CWM protocols. And this is one of the only way we have not applied AGC in this way before in the other site. So we're excited to try to use the AGC in this way to apply it to not just not necessarily leave things in the ground and walk away, but to select between how we dig them. So in summary, so Marshall 3 is an area that was used in Redstone Arsenal in the 1950s for waste disposal, which include munitions, construction debris, and so on. During the phase one intrusive investigation of the site, evidence of chemical munitions, potential CWM, and burn pits and chemical drum debris were found. And the geophysical data collection from EM61 assessed within MRS2 as having over 12,000 individual anomalies and 2 acres of saturated response area. And using AGC data collection, we were able to refine those anomaly counts to have the acreage of the saturated response areas within MRS2 to be reduced almost 20%. And then the individual anomalies did increase to 17,000. However, the AGC data collection and data allowed us to reduce our anomalies that we have to dig under our chemical CWM protocols to under 700. And currently we are conducting our phase 2 interim measure, and we've intrusively investigated all of our CWMs, our TOIs, and we're intrusively investigating our area targets. And then the rest we will remove under our CWM contingency protocol. So the take home here is that by using AGC to refine our CSM, we were able to reduce the level of effort we would have to do to conduct the interim measure at the site. And that's it. Are there any questions?
All right. We do have actually about 9 questions, so we may be running right on schedule here. First question is, how are boundaries for the MRS areas defined?
So they're based on site use. So I will scroll to just on the based on the historical site use. So we have the disposal area where soil was excavated and placed here on historic area 3E. And then the boneyard area where we had just this general disposal, and then our 82 and 82 South, which were had a little bit different site use. So it's basically based on site usage.
Okay, next question. Hold on. All right, can you talk about white phosphorus? Was any detected? How did you characterize and respond with that on site?
Yes, we did have some white phosphorus encountered during the phase one investigation. ADEM has some strict requirements in our permit. We are permitted to dispose of, for the entirety of Redstone Arsenal, 80 pounds of white phosphorus in our OBOD area per year. And we haven't found any yet during the phase two but we anticipate we will find white phosphorus. And we are still working through the disposal methods with ADEM on that. We've got several options on the table, but that's white phosphorus is difficult because it's not a CWM, and it's not really something the regulators allow us to dispose of in a conventional way. So.
Okay. This question was asked in the last presentation, but how are you storing your site data? What visualization tool are you being used? Or is being used?
I'm not too familiar with that. I know that our contractors have their database, and they do a reference all of their data, but I'm not too familiar with how we do it beyond that.
Okay. How many mobilization did you do to the site to complete the RI work?
Okay, so the phase one investigation, it took place over a couple of years. We had in 2013 to 2014, that's when we did our data collection for geophysics. And then we then did some additional AGC surveys in 2015 and 2016. So that phase one characterization finished in 2016. And then we started, I think 2019, I think, is about when we started the current, our phase two activities. And that should take, this field work should take several years to complete. And then after all of that is done, we will move on to the RFI phase of which we still have to produce an RFI for the site. So we're going to be there a while.
Okay, yeah. What is an SPA?
Okay, so that's a single point anomaly. I try to define in my presentation the first use, to, like for example here, and that's where the geophysical data collected identifies something in the ground that's not normal, like not, couldn't be there, so to speak. So it's not soil, it's something that's anomalous to the soil of the site, and that it could be a possible munition, it could be munitions debris. It's hard to tell until we dig it up.
All right, let's see here. Okay, did you use any historical aerial image to help in your initial conceptual site model? Old sandboard maps and old photos have oftentimes given us locations to start sampling that we would never have known about based just on old documents.
Yeah, when we were doing our phase one investigation, we have LIDAR images of Redstone Arsenal, and this site wasn't particularly, we also look at historical imagery as well to see where areas could be disturbed. So we do that. Some other sites on Redstone, we have definitely found using LIDAR, we can see disposal trenches very clearly. So those are very helpful for us. And we always do look at historical imagery over time. It can be very useful, I think.
Okay. Will you be providing training or standoffs on using AGC at future sites?
Well, I'm no geophysicist, so I certainly wouldn't want to teach people anything about AGC, but I'm sure as the Corps starts to learn more, use this technology more and learn how we can use it in its limitations, I think the Corps will definitely present more about that, and the more sites you do this at, we'll definitely have a lot more information to share with everyone, with the community.
Okay. You mentioned there were 672 TOIs. What number of those TOIs were 4.2 mortars or other mech?
I don't have the exact list, but I think about 100 of them were 4.2H mortars, and we had a lot of pipes in that list of the 672. So, a 4-inch pipe will probably look very similar to a 4.2-inch mortar. And what was the second part? How many were 4.2 and what else?
Or other mech.
Okay, yeah. I don't believe we've had, of those 672, we didn't have other mech. And And all of those 4.2-inch mortars that we found were none of them were CWM, and none of them were MEC items. They were MD items. So.
Okay. What type of sampling methodology was used in collecting environmental samples, discrete, composite, miscellaneous, etc.? Why specifically was that methodology selected over the others? How were the results of the environmental sampling used in identifying IM alternatives and identifying the select IM?
So we did discrete sampling during our phase one investigation. And because this isn't an RFI level investigation, we do take those samples and the results and perform a risk assessment, but none of the levels of anything found, that's not part of the presentation, but I think we might've found some groundwater contamination, and maybe, I don't believe we had anything soil-wise that were above risk levels, but nothing was at the level that required a near-term, that posed a near-term unacceptable risk, whereas we do have MEC that does. So there will be further soil sampling, environmental sampling taking place during the RFI investigation. And if there is any, you know, exceedances that require addressing because of risk, those will be taken care of during the corrective measures after the RFI.
Okay. What is the current AGC confidence level? Additionally, how do you account for TOI at a testing facility if the munition item is not included in the classification database? Then the AGC data evaluation for reducing the digs may miss items of interest.
Okay, that was long. What was the first portion?
Let me break this down. What is the current AGC confidence level?
Okay. Well, it depends on who you ask, but I think at this site, because we're using it to refine our CSM, and I'm confident in it, but of course, it's a tool that it does have limitations. For example, if you have items, and Richard addressed this as well, that are deeper than your detection limit. So that can affect your confidence and what your AGC is telling you. Now, what was the second part about the target area?
Okay. Additionally, how do you account for TOIs at a testing facility?
Okay. So the all of the items that we're finding here can be attributed to the historical operations at the site. The testing facility for NASA, these are test stands, like I mentioned, Blue Origin. They have a test stand just west of our site. There's also another test stand east of our site, and their activities are separate from the historical background. And we have had sites where we do find munitions explosives of concern at the site, but it's not historical. It might be like a tow missile, so that would not change our conceptual site model for the site, because our purpose is to deal with the historical cleanup and not what's currently there because of present day activity.
All right. We only got a couple more minutes before the next presentation, and I got two more questions here. So we're going to go ahead and move on to the next question. Can you describe the efficiency of AGC use on a disposal site where various metallic debris and multiple target areas?
So, yeah, you've got things for, there's more, I'm sorry.
There's just a little bit more here. Is the use of AGC in the sites meant to identify potential CWM only?
So we're using AGC with that purpose here. We're using it to establish which items are possible CWM and which are not, so that we can, that can affect our intermeasure activities. So that's how we're applying AGC at this site. And we do plan to do this at other sites on Redstone. We're using it to help us just decide where to dig, because under CWM protocols, because Redstone has a lot of areas that are used, and you know, and it also reduces our workload as far as the night operations and so on.
Okay. We just ran out of time. We had one last question. I think it would have been a long one to answer, but I'm going to go ahead and just read it anyways. Could you please describe the RCRA Subpart X requirements for treatment disposal of MEC, MD, and CWA, burn pits, etc.? I think that's going to be a long answer. So what we can do is maybe we can shelf that till after, at the end of the presentations for later. Okay. But that's all the questions. So you did a great job. Appreciate it, Dr. McDonald. And we're going to move on to our next presentation. Julie Ainge, if you go ahead and fire up your share screen, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Everything looks great.
All right. Sounds good. Okay, so today I'm going to talk about the Wahoo Island Target formerly used defense site. And we're going to go through a brief overview, a little history, the CSM as it was developed throughout the RI, some inconsistencies in the CSM. And then we're going to talk about some CSM elements that we didn't really fully consider in the FS and DD. And then this site's a little bit different in that we are in the remedial action phase. So we've had some field work to this point, and we'll talk about that and some possible revisions to the CSM and lessons learned. Acronyms, hopefully everybody's familiar with most of these. We will talk about MPPH, or material potentially presenting an explosive hazard, which I don't think we've talked about too much yet today. Other than that, I think most of these are pretty standard. So first of all, site overview, the Oahu Island Target FUD's property is the entire property, and we are going to specifically talk about the Target Islands and Surrounding Waters MRS. That's about 57 acres, and it's located off the northeast coast of Oahu. Initially, the property prior to conducting the RI was the entire beige area that's shown here. The three light colored areas that are called out are the Target Islands MRS. And then there's also a couple of features to point out here. There is a state recreation area right here. There is Laie Point, which is a popular tourist stop off right here. And just for reference, if you've been to this part of Oahu, the Polynesian Cultural Center is sort of back here. Historically, these sites were used as bombing targets. They were the first island, Muku'awiya, was also known as Goat Island, was leased in May 1943. There was a separate lease for the three target islands in our MRS. And in 1952, there was a surface clearance of this island here. It's the only one that has any soil on it. The three target islands in our MRS are strictly rocks. And then in February 1953, all of the islands were formally transferred back to this territory at the time. In the early 80s, there was an EOD clearance that was done around that northernmost island, which was primarily large bombs and some 8-inch projectiles. 2008, there was a site inspection for the MRA. It was just visual inspection of the islands, the three target islands that are in our MRS. Only MD was observed, no metal fragments. There was soil sampling on Goat Island that didn't reveal any MC contamination, but the three islands in our target MRS do not have any soil to sample. So then we move on to the remedial investigation. And those field activities were conducted September through mid-October of 2012. There was no further inspection of the islands themselves. The RI consisted of some visual snorkel transects, side scan sonar, and scuba transects, which we'll talk more about in just a minute. 13 munitions items were located and destroyed, 5 and 6 inch projectiles, 20 pound fragment bombs, and 3.5 inch rocket warheads. The highest mech density was estimated at about 3 items an acre. And at the conclusion of the RI, the target islands and surrounding waters MRS was delineated out. That was initially, there was a recommendation to do each island separately, but they were in the end combined and the rest of the MRA became no action in a decision document. So for a visual of the RI investigation, this kind of beige area over here, which goes from shoreline to 12 feet deep, was done with visual snorkel transects. Out here in the blue, we did side scan sonar. And then because that had trouble seeing up around the islands, they added 100 meter scuba transects that were more or less radial to the islands themselves. But you can see they're not really evenly spaced. And they're, the divers, I'm sure, had a very hard time staying in a straight line. So for the snorkel, again, up to 12 feet deep. And if there was sand, they did do scuba diving to investigate that sand. For the side scan sonar, they had some issues because of the rough seas at the time. Like I said, this was done in September and October, which is not the best time of year for weather at the site. And so they ended up having to change from a towed array to a hull mounted configuration for the sonar. And then, like I said, they had to add the scuba transects. They identified 133 sonar targets. And then they sent divers to investigate 100% of those. The other thing about the side scan sonar is that the seas were so rough that they could not travel parallel to the islands. They had to go into and out of the waves. So that was another change to the work plan going into this. This is a visual of the side scan sonar TOI. You can see, you know, it's mostly that north-south pattern that you would expect. And then here's what was identified as MEC and MD at the end of the RI. Just a quick overview of what munitions were found at which island. This is, of course, from moving from the north to the south. And then for demo, they actually saved all of the items to do demo at the end of the field work. They did all of them via blow in place, even though they had planned to do consolidation, and that wasn't really fully explained in the RI report. The other thing to note with this is that they had trouble identifying a lot of the items prior to conducting demo and used fragments that were left over for identification. So here we have our estimated mech density straight out of the RI report. I'm not entirely sure how they estimated this because it's mostly off of those transects that were certainly not evenly spaced and they were more or less radial. So somebody had to do something a little fancy with some VSB to get this. The major challenge during the RI were the sea conditions. Fall, it's starting to get into a really rough season. There's nothing at this site to break up waves as they're coming in. You know, there's no reefs, no large reefs or anything. The wind speeds were 20, 23 miles an hour most of the time they were out there. That resulted in like 6 to 8 foot wind waves and additional 3 to 4 foot swell. So that would be fairly rough conditions, and they had a really hard time just getting through the RA at that time of year. So the I'm going to run through the RI from CSM really quickly. Just going to highlight a few things really here, though. The MRS boundaries, this is at the end of the RI, are notional and based on fragmentation buffer areas for submerged munitions at 18 meters or more. I think that probably did not get updated from the pre-RI CSM, but that was just an interesting thing to note. The physical profile, the munitions themselves are ranging from the shore of those three islands, which goes to depth of about 5 meters, just basically straight down. So minimum of say 16 feet-ish of water out to about 15 meters at the edges of the defined MRSs, or the defined MRS, sorry. They stated that no significant sand areas existed within the target island's MRS. There's reefs, but not like, they're mostly fish habitat. They're not any like special reefs that a lot of people would want to be diving and looking at. For the land use and exposure profile, this is a very interesting one. During rare calm ocean periods, the target islands may be accessed by swimmers, and this is considered a rare occurrence. Their only human receptors that they were considering were recreational users. And then for ecological, there are endangered species. We've got green sea turtles, Hawaiian monk seals, there's some birds. Of course, these islands are managed currently as bird sanctuaries. And then during the migration season, there are humpback whales off shore of these islands. UXO and MD were discovered on the ocean floor surface. Penetration of the flat rock is not anticipated. And of course, there weren't a whole lot of sand areas that they located. And then our exposure is going to be direct contact by humans and wildlife with munitions on the seafloor. There wasn't really any expectation that they were going to migrate, as most of them were affixed to the seafloor, unless, you know, somebody actually tried to release them. And then we get to the pathway, and we state that the MRS waters are frequented by fishermen, divers, and snorkelers who may encounter UXO on the seafloor, so the pathway is complete. And then for MC, it's an underwater environment, so they considered that one incomplete. Something else of note to consider is when you move on to the METCA, because of course this preceded the risk matrices, there's several things to think about with accessibility. The distance to the islands themselves, which, you know, they're 3/4 to a mile offshore, to interact with those munitions requires a boat or to swim that distance. And then once you get there, you've got to get down at least 15, 16 feet to get to the first munitions. There's also the possibility of dropping a boat anchor on the UXO. But in addition to that, it's not easy to get there in a boat. The nearest boat ramp 6 miles away, and it's kind of limiting vessel size. And in addition, what we found, sea state, during most of the year is not conducive to having smaller craft out there. And so for those reasons, the Met Ha said that it was not frequented by large numbers of people, and under a baseline assessment, the sites would be considered very limited accessibility. But just because it's limited doesn't mean that nobody ever accesses the islands. Also, as part of the RI, there were three interviews conducted. All three of those interviewees reported diving off of the coast of that southern island here. And one of them also stated that they would dive and collect items off the seafloor around the central one. And you can kind of see from this why this island may be more accessible. Just the distance is not quite so great. There's kind of a path here, and the conditions make that a little less likely that people are going to swim out there. So then in the FS, really we considered land use controls as a general technology, removal and then disposal with blow in place or consolidated shots, only using high explosives. And they did note that it's potentially destructive of the coral, and that potentially we might have to do a BIP if items are unsafe to move or affixed to the seafloor. But otherwise, the preference was going to be for consolidated shots. For ARRs, just of note, there's the Endangered Species Act, marine mammals, Hawaii regulations on stony corals and live rocks. So lots to consider there. In the FS, the actual alternatives, of course, we had no action, land use controls only, surface and subsurface, mech removal with land use controls. And there was also a fourth alternative, which was for UUE, that was considered to not be implementable. Alternative three, again, if mechs deemed unsafe to move, it would be BIPped. Otherwise, or if it would damage live rock or coral, it would be left in place and not destroyed. The goal, 100% removal. And there is this little thing over here about demo phase will require coordination with all these people, which turned out to be a little bit more difficult than I think was anticipated. So in the DD, the selected remedy is mech removal from the surface and subsurface of the seafloor and LUX. No further investigation of the islands, and then to implement a land use control program with signs and safety education. And our REO was to provide protection to human health by reducing or mitigating the potential hazards posed by mech associated with reasonably anticipated future use. So also in the DD, in the executive summary, we're still talking about recreational uses, including primitive camping and rustic cabins for rent, which is clearly still talking about the state recreation area. That's part of the MRA, but not the MRS, but the DD doesn't make any distinction there. We're talking about site visitors for the first time, with no mention of what those site visitors are actually doing or how they would interact with munitions on the seafloor. And we start talking about scuba divers being at the site. We also note that the MRS is open to the public, which is true, and that it's heavily used, which completely contradicts what's in the risk assessment portion of the RI. And then finally, it also includes subsurface seafloor munitions, and we state that they could migrate via natural processes. So somehow between the RI and the DD, that also manage to change. So that brings us to the remedial action that was the latest action at the site. So the goal was obviously to implement the remedy. We installed signs at the state recreation area and distributed educational materials, completed a survey of the MRS boundaries, which identified 215 MPPH, including some much larger bombs that had been dropped from the CSM in the RI. And then we pilot tested a Vulcan low-order deflagration disposal method. Project stakeholders, USACE Honolulu and Huntsville Design Center. We had the Hawaii Department of Health and then the Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources, which manages that property. And then we had NOAA NIMS. So for the remedial action approach, we conducted instrument-assisted diver surveys over the entirety of the defined MRSs around the islands. That was conducted March through October 2019. We took a break for 2020 when Hawaii was locked down for COVID, and then started again in March through May of 2021. The divers had, you know, dive boards, propulsion, and analog detectors, and Shark Marine GPS equipment. The dive teams had five members, one in the water and four on the surface providing support. They launched in inflatable boats from the shore for the most part. And then the divers swam the transects. If they found an item, they stopped, investigated, took pictures of both the item and the surrounding area to see, you know, what all sensitive species may be around it. Of note, they found a lot of heavy marine growth on the munitions, and so they used a best guess at identifying munitions based on measurements and historical knowledge. And also of note, they ended up having to be ready to work, you know, any of 7 days a week due to the sea states, because even though they were conducting operations in the summertime when it's calmer, that doesn't mean it's actually calm most of the time. Summer is also hurricane season, and it does not take a full hurricane to cause the site to get pretty rough. Just a normal summer storm or a low pressure system is plenty to do that. So our biggest problem, as you might guess, was being able to do demo on these items that were found. As soon as we got into the SPP meetings with all the stakeholders, they started raising concerns about using high explosives. The originally proposed method of demo was to put a bubble curtain around the items. The stakeholders didn't think that there was enough information on how much of an impact that bubble curtain would have in lowering the explosive effects. So while we were working on trying to figure out that piece of it to give them some more information, the contractor actually decided that it might not be terribly effective to use a bubble curtain anyway. So we punted on that idea and started looking for another option. Additionally, our OESS and our explosive safety people thought that, you know, moving MPPH that was submitted to the seafloor might not be ideal for something like consolidation. And there's no land within the MRS that's really suitable to conduct consolidated shots out of the water. So that really wasn't an option. And so demo operations were deferred until the PDT could reach agreement on suitable demo methods. We did eventually gain concurrence on proceeding with the Vulcan system, which works through deflagration without detonation. And that actually ended up being limited by the field season. So results so far for the remedial action. The dive teams have surveyed all of the defined MRS. They found 215 MPPH that were identified, which works out to about 4 items an acre, which is considerably more than the RI would have predicted. And the density was up to about 16 items an acre. We did conduct that pilot shot with the Vulcan system, which was very successful. And then we had one other demo event in 2021 before the weather conditions just got too bad to do anything else. And these pictures are just because most of the time the site is really rough, but you can also see in these, it can smooth out and how people might actually be able to get out to these sites. We did identify additional types of MPPH, quite a few actually. And the survey results indicated that there's certainly potential for more to be outside of the currently defined boundaries, including there was a 5-inch projectile that a diver just happened to pass over when he got washed out of one of his transect lanes. So just visually, very quickly, these are the finds from each of the islands moving north to south. And you can see, you know, we're up very close to the boundary on all of these. And that's the 5-inch projectile that was found outside. But there's quite a bit around the boundaries there. Just quickly, the types and what was found where, the larger bombs were all in the north, which is where that EOD operation was conducted in the 80s. And then, you know, things that we were expecting more or less, the moving further to the south. This is the revised CSM out of the draft unreviewed by the PDT, site-specific final report from the current action. And you can see that we are sort of moving towards getting this refined a little bit, added the additional types, potential types of mech. We did start talking about mech being cemented to the seafloor and embedded in coral, which is the typical way that it's going to be found. Very low potential for migration, and the sand lenses aren't really a big issue. They're shallow. But we still have scuba divers and our receptors. And we still got site visitors, and we still haven't explained what they're doing. So what did we learn? That at the conclusion of the RI, the CSM wasn't really consistent for land use receptors or exposure profile. And that really could have been solved by just making sure when the CSM was updated, when the site was delineated, that we were being consistent for what's inside the new MRS versus what's outside of it. It didn't fully capture nature or extent. And then it also sort of glossed over some of those conditions that could be expected for remedial action, such as weather and sea state, which in the RI and the FS, they just basically said, the weather's better in the summer, so it'll be great. Just do it then. And then we didn't really fully consider protected species, especially the monk seal that lives in the area. You know, we didn't think about things like repeated exposures and how we were going to enforce an exclusion zone for those species, which is a little bit different than trying to do it for people. The remedial alternatives analysis in the FS, we didn't really consider the full CSM. Like I said, how are you going to enforce that that exclusion zone? Is it really realistic to say we're going to consolidate things that are primarily, if not all, affixed to the seafloor? And, you know, we didn't really talk to the stakeholders until we got to the remedial action. And then we tried to take care of those concerns. It might have been better to do it ahead of time. And finally, if we had conducted the pre-RFP project scoping SPP meetings to reach consensus on the CSM and DQOs, that probably would have helped the PDT recognize most of those problems before we got to releasing a contract. And it would have likely made the process quite a bit smoother. And that's the end.
Thank you very much, Julie. That was really, really great. Well, I got about 8 questions or so here lined up for you. So let's go ahead and knock these out. Let's see. The first one here is, what is a visual snorkel transaction? Is there any underwater video or photos taken as part of that?
There's not a visual. Okay, so a visual snorkel transect is someone snorkeling, visually looking at the ocean floor. It wasn't instrument assisted or anything of that nature. I don't know about video. I was not part of the PDT at that point.
Okay. Did you do investigation below the sediment surface? If so, how deep?
They did go down and investigate any sand covered areas. The floor of the ocean at this location is basically just bedrock. I mean, there's not much on it unless there's a depression, and then there may be a bit of sand. It's a highly dynamic environment, so there's not much that can settle there.
Okay. Was the site seeded in advance of side scan sonar survey? How were the seeds deployed?
I don't know the answer to that question. Like I said, I was not part of the RI team, and no one that's currently on the PDT was involved with that.
Okay. Did you consider postponing the RI work till weather was better?
Was that the RI work or the RA work? I don't know. Like I said, I don't know if they considered postponing or not. It would perhaps have given them a better idea of what conditions to expect if they had tried to do it at a more ideal time. But I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. Is the area where side scan sonar only was used considered a data gap?
It was not at the time, no.
Okay. Some of these other ones here discuss a private contractor that has access to Vulcan technology and has data to support the minimal environmental impact of low-order defligation techniques. I can't sit here and talk about a private contractor. That would be, advertising for them. So I don't feel comfortable about reading these next questions because they bring up this contractor in here. Other than that, what we have here is some many thanks for a great session. Thanks for hosting all this stuff. So that's all the questions I really have for you. Dr. McDonald is still on, I got one question for her, if we can switch over to her.
Yeah.
Okay, for the last question, could you please describe the RCRA Subpart X requirements for treatment disposal of MEC, MD, CW, a CWM, they put CWA, but a CWM, burn pits, and et cetera?
Yes, so if we have conventional MEC items found at a site, our contractor disposes of those items. If we have, which we haven't found any yet at Redstone, but if we have a CWM item, then the government would take that. Those are initially, once they're assessed to be CWM, there's a big long process for that. then the government would be responsible for the destruction of those items. And then we have the white phosphorus, which is kind of the in-between that we're trying to work through. And likely what ultimately would happen at Redstone is we will have destruction technology. We are permitted for an electrostatic or an EDS detonation chamber. We don't have one yet at Redstone because we haven't started to. Marshall 3 is our first intermeasure site where we're doing and removing items to be that might be needed, that the destruction technology might be needed for. So I hope that answers everything.
Hope so. Okay. This is last call for questions. We've got about 5 minutes before the end of our session. So we've got the three instructors still online. Any questions at all from anybody? Just type in the QA and we can get it answered. If nobody has any questions, then we will go ahead and close this out.
And Jeff, this is Jean. I'll just offer a quick suggestion to the audience. If they have no questions, they can also send that message into the Q&A and confirm that they are thoroughly satisfied with our time usage and that they don't have any additional questions for our instructors. You can also drop that in the Q&A. That's just as helpful. And while we wait, do you mind if I pull up that reminder for our next session?
Oh, please. All right, as you can see on the screen, this is the next upcoming webinar. Go ahead and put it on your calendars. If you haven't seen the invite that was sent out through multiple agencies, and if not, just keep a look on Glue-In's website, and you can find it there. That's where you have to register anyways, just like this one. So that's all I have. I'd like to thank our presenters, Mr. Perry, Dr. McDonald, and Ms. Ainge, and thank you all for putting on a great presentation today. Did very well. I don't think I've had instructors be that on time for everything. Well done. And I'm going to turn that over to Jean.
All right. Thank you so very much, Jeff. And I echo your thanks to each of our presenters for offering their expertise and staying right to schedule for today's session. I also want to thank the over 170 individuals who joined us for today's live session. We really appreciated you taking time out of your busy schedules and sharing your questions and comments for our presenters today. We hope that you can join us on a future webinar. Remember, we're offering these through the Cleanup Information Network at clueIn.org. So I encourage you to visit us there. And sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month. So if you're interested in staying informed when we have additional webinars, such as today's session, be sure to add yourself to that free monthly newsletter. The other thing I wanted to cover for anyone who may have joined us late, remember there is a seminar homepage that has been dedicated for this particular session with information about our speakers, as well as links to download their presentation material. So it's shown here in red on this URL here, so you can bookmark that and save it. It's the same website that you went to when signing up. It's the same website that you went to when checking in for today. It's the same website that we would have included in all of your reminder emails as well. So if you're looking for copies of those presentation materials, you will find it there on the seminar homepage. And I do often get asked if we offer CEUs or PDHs for participation in our session, and I don't offer those types of credit hours, but I can provide you with a webinar certificate. So if you fill out the online feedback form, which is accessible from the seminar homepage, you'll be a box at the very bottom of that feedback form. As long as you check that box to certify you are here for the entire live session and then submit your feedback form, you'll immediately have access to a participation certificate that you can then save or print out for your own records. We will also email a copy of it to you, but I do know sometimes junk or spam filters will block those emails. So I encourage that you download it from that confirmation screen right when you submit your feedback form. If you happen to have multiple people participating from your particular location, each person can fill out that feedback form, even if they didn't register individually. So if you are the one who signed the group up, I encourage you to go ahead and copy the website to the seminar homepage and then share that with your colleagues so that they can fill out their own feedback and get their own certificate. And I do read each and every one of these forms. We really do count on and appreciate your insights to help us to continue to improve our webinars. So again, just a quick gentle reminder that that seminar homepage is available from today forward. If you happen to be one of the lucky people watching the recorded version of today's webinar, right about now, somewhere over my head in the upper right corner in the online version, you'll also see a link to that very same feedback form. You can click that button, fill out feedback based off of your replay of the archive. Again, noting that you'll need to check that box, certifying you watched the whole thing. And then you too can get a participation certificate based off of your replay for your own records. Our recording should be available in about 1 week. You'll automatically get an email from me as soon as that archive is available for on-demand playback. So with that, reaching our scheduled end time, I have concluded all of my final reminders. So just one great big thank you to you all for joining us. And we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.